Welcome to The Offseason. I'm your host, Dr. Cokes. The Offseason is an exploration of athletic health, recovery, and performance told through stories of athletes and their medical and training team. Now for a quick but mandatory medical disclaimer. This podcast is for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of naturopathic medicine or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No patient-doctor relationship is formed. Use of this material is at user's own risk. Listeners should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any conditions they may have and should seek assistance from their trusted healthcare professional for any condition. This podcast does not speak on behalf of naturopathic medicine and does not represent the views of the profession as a whole.
Hey guys, I hope everyone who celebrates had a lovely Christmas break. This week we're on with Dr. Darren Kandow, who is a professor at the University of Regina in exercise physiology and metabolism, and he is probably the most versed researcher in creatine. So we go in the ins and outs of creatine, we talk about type, dosage, timing, all of your burning questions about creatine. And then we also speak to creatine for female athletes. So we get into the nitty gritty there. I hope you guys pull some information from this. I found it fascinating. Enjoy.
Hey, Darren, welcome to the off season.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Amazing. So I heard you on Barbell Shrugged and I was like, oh no, I have to talk to this guy. I wonder if he would ever do a podcast with me. And, you know, the guys over at Barbell are legit. They're doing their stuff. So I was so appreciative that you were going to take the time and hang out with me for a little bit.
Absolutely. And I see your diplomas behind you in the East Coast. So my Acadia one's on my right hand shoulder. So there we go. It's a East Coast party all across Canada, basically. Yeah.
Amazing. I love it. So you are the, let's call it like creatine guru. And just as you were mentioning before we started here today that, like in my experience, yeah, creatine got put on a little bit of a shelf. We knew it had these benefits for muscle growth, and we knew, you know, like in the gym, we would just assume a lot of those people are taking it, and we knew what it was good for. But there's so many evolutions of it now, and so much stuff coming out about it. How did you get into creatine? Where did all of this start from?
It's an interesting story. When I did my graduate school at the University of Saskatchewan, I met a fellow colleague, former professor at St. of X, Darren Burke, and he was doing some creatine research. And basically, I owe a lot of my career to Dr. Darren Burke and my mentor, Phil Chilovic at the U of S. We kind of just started to do some ergogenic aid research. And we dabbled in protein, and my master's was on glutamine. And Darren actually had some funding to do some creatine monohydrate research. And at that time, creatine was just really gaining momentum. It was probably, you know, the most hyped supplement, and it was starting to get a lot of evidence-based research behind it, was really backing it. And I got very fortunate. I worked with two phenomenal researchers, and lo and behold, ever since 2001, my first publication, we've been doing a lot of stuff ever since. And to your point, I think creatine research got a little complacent. It was just seeming to be really, really effective from a muscle performance standpoint. Athletes were getting bigger, stronger, faster, and that's really where it got its legs. And then all of a sudden, we started to switch into the health and clinical aspects of creatine, and that's really where the focus point seems to be. The main focus of my research program is on healthy aging, and of course now, then the last probably decade, brain health and function has become so prevalent. That's even independent of COVID and the mental health issues with COVID-19, but it's really sort of taken on a second life. And I'll be probably researching creatine for the next 20 or 30 years and still be left with answers and questions after that.
I think that's so interesting. And I think, you know, when we think about the medical side of things, we assume if you're, you know, a PhD or if you have some of this backing that you should know a little bit about everything, and not to take that away from you, I'm sure you do, but this is the exact case. Like you could pick any supplement and just like become obsessed over it. You could break it down and see all of the applications for it. So you kind of fell into creatine and it just seemed to work for a while, hey?
Yeah. And, you know, we naturally produce this molecule. So it's not like a steroid, or it's unlike caffeine. And creatine to this day is still the most researched, safest ergogenic aid out there. And it had its place in athletes, but all of a sudden now it has a whole bunch of medical and clinical applications. We're doing a symposium at the American College of Sports Medicine Conference in Colorado just on the health and clinical aspects of creatine. So it has evolved quite substantially. So it's not just for athletes. In general, every person on the planet including children, can probably consider creatine supplementation or an increase in dietary creatine. It seemed to have a lot of benefits.
I love this. And I think I even remember growing up that when my brother brought the tub of creatine to my mom and there was like a panic that ensued. And I still see this in practice all of the time. So the young athletes that come in, I certainly have it on my roster of things to suggest. And moms are still extremely apprehensive, or parents are still really apprehensive of creatine supplementation. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so it was a lot of myths, and we put out a paper a couple of years ago about the myths and misconceptions around creatine. I think where this stemmed is because it works so well pretty much for everybody, people thought it was too good to be true. And then the International Olympic Committee has actually now designated creatine as a very effective, safe dietary compound. So we are just naturally producing this in the kidneys and liver, but we also can get creatine through red meat and seafood. The issue is to get the amount shown to be effective, it's very difficult through the diet. So a lot of people will buy this jug of powder. And I can't stress enough for those listening, please only focus on creatine monohydrate. There's a lot of other purported or marketed forms of creatine out there that just have not been supported by evidence-based research, primarily to be safe. So again, if you're looking for creatine, make sure it's creatine monohydrate, and maybe later on we can talk about why that is. But it was just a boring type of white powder. You would mix it in water or yogurt, whichever, and it wasn't flashy. It didn't have a lot of marketing tools behind it. And then all of a sudden people thought, well, this is almost too good to be true because I've noticed I can increase my weight training performance. I could actually recover better from exercise. And now we're actually seeing huge benefits on cognition, memory, sleep deprivation. So if you understand the molecule, it's in our cells. It's also in our brain and muscle and bone. And actually that's the areas that we are trying to focus on. So I think where creatine is different than protein, there wasn't a lot of information out there even taught in physiology classes on this supplement, whereas I think most of us are well poised with dietary protein, carbohydrates, and fat. And that's where it's up to individuals like ourselves to produce evidence-based research to the average individual to get scientific information regarding any type of dietary compound.
Definitely. And would you say, like, with all of your research, is there any risks involved in taking it?
The big risk we see is if an individual does the loading phase, and that's typically 20 grams a day for about 5 to 7 days, and they have pre-existing kidney or liver abnormalities. The kidneys and liver will actually filter creatine very effectively, even if someone has a dialysis or other compromised renal or liver conditions. But the only side effect actually we see is acute water retention, usually during the first week, if you just do the loading phase. We've looked at blood cells, liver, kidney for 2 consecutive years in postmenopausal females, and we find no adverse effects. And there's other labs that have looked at the effects on cardiovascular health. And again, there's no side effects. And that kind of goes back to, oh, this must be too good to be true. But I would argue, since we naturally are producing this about 2 to 3 grams a day, it's very difficult to have side effects from even an ergogenic aid if you're naturally synthesizing it within the recommended daily dosages. It doesn't cause a drug effect like caffeine. It's just naturally produced. Yeah,
I get you. So I have so many questions about, you know, dosing, supplementation. Sure. And I think like every, I don't know, GNC or Popeyes that you walk into, there's like these different formulations and saying one is better than the other. So can you speak to, you know, creatine monohydrate, why that is the best? And is there certain derivatives or manufacturing methods of creatine monohydrate that would be better than others?
Yeah, so creatine monohydrate, the really cool thing with monohydrate, meaning single water attached to the creatine molecule, is when you ingest creatine monohydrate, by the time the molecule gets to your GI tract area, the water molecules disassociates into your bloodstream. What's remaining is a creatine molecule, which is identical to the one released from your liver. So the really interesting thing here is creatine monohydrate, once it's metabolized and enters your circulation or bloodstream, it's identical to what you're naturally producing in the liver. There's other marketed forms of creatine that are very flashy, creatine hydrochloride and citrate and all that. Not one study has shown that any marketed form of creatine is better than monohydrate, especially getting into the tissue where it needs to be. Some have shown it gets into the bloodstream equally as high or even higher. That's great. But unless it gets into the demanding tissue and actually leads to beneficial effects, it's ineffective or inferior, so to speak. So I only focus on monohydrate. It's true and tied and trusted. It's actually been supported by over 1,000 peer refereed articles. Now, the issue is creatine monohydrate is boring from a marketing standpoint. It's not flashy. So a lot of companies will say, we want you to try this creatine and others. And my argument is creatine monohydrate is almost 100% bioavailable. That means when you digest it, even when it goes through the stomach and small intestine, about 100% near capacity, it gets in your bloodstream. And then, of course, it's very unique and gets taken into your muscle, bone, or brain, whereas the others, we don't know. So I think if anybody's listening and they're thinking of creatine supplementation, please only focus on monohydrate and make sure it's certified safe and it's pure. This is independent of other ingredients, so to speak. Some compounds have multiple ingredients over time.
Definitely. Would you have or be familiar with the product EFX puts out, the Cre-Alkaline, I think?
Yep, they're all purported. So at the end of the day, if it has the creatine molecule, that's great. That's the number one thing. Then it has to get into circulation. And then more importantly, they all sort of seem to have some preliminary evidence that it might get in the bloodstream, but it's got to get into the tissue. It makes no beneficial effect by having creatine get into the blood and not get through those doorways into the muscle, bone, or brain. And we can talk about dosing, the loading phase versus maintenance. And the 5 grams a day is very outdated from a holistic body perspective. I'm one of the few researchers that will say, whoa, that's only from a really narrow lens. The 5 grams a day is only from a muscle perspective. There's other areas of the body that we need to focus on that typically do require higher doses. Dosages.
Definitely. What are these higher dosages and what would we be looking at for muscle specific?
Yeah. So from a muscle perspective, if you want to do the loading phase, which is 20 grams a day, that's the most effective and reliable way to totally saturate your muscle. Your muscle is unique. It only has a maximal storing capacity. So 20 grams of creatine a day for about 5 to 7 days totally saturates your muscle. Sadly, though, halfway through that loading phase, you excrete in the urine half the amount of supplement you're consuming. Now, I already mentioned that some of the adverse effects some people may hear of, acute water retention comes to mind, is when the loading phase occurs. And most people don't like that, especially young females. They will withdraw from the studies. So we don't do a loading phase typically unless it's an older population. We usually base it on body weight, 0.1 gram of creatine per kilogram. So if you're 70 kilograms, you start with 7 grams a day. If you're 100 kilograms, you get 10 grams a day. It's very similar to the dose of caffeine you consume. We base it on the size of the person. The rationale there is the larger the person, the larger the muscle mass, they may have more doorways to allow creatine into the cell, and that's the justification there. So that's from a muscle perspective. Now, after you come off the loading phase, you can reduce that to about 3 to 5 grams a day. And so this is where it's very popular. Most people say, hey, if you don't want the loading phase, that's great. In just 3 to 5 grams a day, that's perfect from a muscle perspective. It'll saturate your muscles in about 28 days. And then you can just take that for the rest of your life. I will say we've focused on bone health, and the lowest effective dose for bone health in combination with weight training is 8 grams. So now you're looking at, do different tissues of the body demand different requirements? I will say there's never been a comparison of different dosages, like 5 grams versus 8 versus higher for bone. But the current body of evidence suggests that 5 grams of creatine may not be enough. The minimal effective dose is 8 grams, and that's primarily for postmenopausal females. Now, when we get to the brain, it's very unique. Our muscles love to suck up creatine because they do not make it. The brain says, well, hang on, we're a bit unique. We have a blood-brain barrier. We don't like a lot of things just getting into the brain. So the brain is unique. It actually makes its own creatine, unlike muscle. And it actually doesn't have the capability to take in creatine like the muscle does. So almost the brain is resistant to supplementation. So the really well-controlled studies have shown that higher dosages, even more than 10 grams a day, up to about 20 grams a day, for multiple weeks is required to fully increase brain creatine stores, which can be implicated for decreasing symptoms of depression, anxiety, sleep deprivation, and improving memory and cognition. So the theory is that different tissues of the body may require different dosages. My overall recommendation, and I take this every day, is 10 grams a day. And that seems to be the global optimal dose on a daily basis for muscle, bone, and brain health, if you're looking at it from a longevity perspective, and also from an anti-inflammatory perspective. A lot of times as you get older, after the fourth decade, inflammation is very, very high, and creatine has been shown to have anti-inflammatory effects. So again, there's no adverse effects. 5 grams, if you take it every day, will have some beneficial effects. But I think, especially for older populations, you may need a little bit more.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I don't know if, you know, a lot of what you do or thought processes, mine's usually of food first. So I'm very curious, like, for such a high dosage of supplementation and how we've evolved over time, would it be that our diet has just changed so drastically that then we would need to supplement all of this to meet the requirements of our body?
Yeah, so this is the interesting one. We always promote food first, and I think you can get all your dietary protein through adequate, healthy food. Now, creatine is a bit different. So the average salmon steak, or sorry, I should preface this, the foods that have dietary creatine are red meat and seafood. So for a vegan, a vegetarian, individuals emphasizing plant-based diets, getting additional dietary creatine is very difficult. And that's usually where supplementation needs to occur. Now, keep in mind, if you don't take any dietary creatine through your diet or supplementation, you're going to live a long, healthy life, no problems whatsoever. So we're not saying you absolutely need supplementation. All I'm saying is that the evidence has shown that additional creatine has had or actually produces some beneficial effects. So the issue here is that you would need about 2 salmon steaks or a large red meat steak to get about 5 grams of creatine a day. We are naturally producing about 2 to 3 grams, but ironically, we excrete about 2 to 3 grams through the kidneys in urine on a daily basis. So research suggests that an additional amount is needed. The minimal amount from a muscle performance perspective is 3 grams. So if you excrete 2 and you need 3 additional, that's where this daily 5 gram serving comes to mind. So if someone says, hey, I just take 5 grams a day, that's very scientifically proven. Again, only from a muscle perspective. So the issue here is if you want to get additional amounts, we theorize a supplementation is probably the most financially effective and easiest way to do it. I don't really want to tell people go to Costco and buy 4 or 5 bags of salmon and red meat. And of course, we've done some preliminary research that vegetarians respond phenomenally well to supplementation because their muscles only contain half the amount of natural creatine compared to someone who is on an omnivore diet. So for those who hear the responders or non-responders, the non-responders are typically individuals who have a high amount of meat or seafood in their diet on a daily basis, whereas the people who seem to respond the best are plant-based individuals, vegetarians, or vegans. So again, your habitual dietary intake, independent of sex or age or your natural genetic heredity, but diet definitely plays a role. In muscle, the cool thing is when it comes to brain creatine content, your diet doesn't influence it whatsoever. It only seems to be the muscle, yeah.
Wow, that's super interesting. Is it just me or have the prices of creatine also skyrocketed around COVID?
Yeah, they have. So the majority of the high-end creatine is synthesized and made in Germany. But there's other derivatives, which I think has the majority of the market pull from Asia. And what happened was during COVID with the customs and the issues with shipping, and of course, we can all attest that the price of groceries has gone up, but the cost of creatine has gone up as well, but it pales in comparison to the cost of red meat or seafood or other dietary compounds. Yeah.
Interesting. Creatine, like the main reason I was super interested is you had mentioned something on Barbell Shrugged about female athletes and menopausal changes. And I was reading a book, The Double X Brain. Have you heard of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I haven't heard of that one. No, yeah.
Super interesting in talking about like the huge correlation to estrogen changes with menopause leading to a 2-fold increased risk factor of Alzheimer's for women. And once I heard you speak about this, I was like, there must be a correlative thing going on here too. So tell me about creatine for females in that perimenopausal, menopausal state.
Yeah, it's a huge focus area and so underrepresented. It's very, when you look at the totality of creatine research, it primarily focuses on young males. And there is emerging evidence in females across the lifespan, including pregnancy, and how the fetal development is actually enhanced during development, primarily because the brain and creatine bioenergetics. But it's well now known that young females over the age of 18 with primarily exercise get a huge improvement in strength, muscle mass, performance, and lean body mass. Body fat, we're just doing a meta-analysis now to see, does creatine decrease body fat in young individuals? We've seen that in older adults. So that's a myth where creatine, a lot of females will say, I don't want to take creatine because it's going to gain body fat. We don't see that at all. It's actually the opposite. But the big focus here has been on postmenopausal females. You take away the cessation of estrogen has some catastrophic effects primarily from a muscle and bone perspective. And we're actually seeing some really good bone beneficial effects in addition to muscle. In postmenopausal females, their bones become stronger and they decrease the rate of bone mineral loss. Now, when it comes to brain health and function, we're not really seeing a huge sex difference. If anything, we're seeing females, and this is primarily in mice and rodent models, have a greater adaptation to creatine than males. And we're not sure why the mechanisms are there, but it does have some huge sex-specific benefits from a female perspective. Again, there's no female on the planet that shouldn't be considering dietary creatine or at least be aware of the benefits. Again, those negative effects primarily occur during the loading phase. And ironically, we actually don't see as much water retention in females compared to males, probably because if you do a relative dose, they're not getting as much.
Interesting. Maybe if we could do it like through the female life cycle. So I'm super passionate about female athletics. And yes. And one of the major changes at puberty, there's a few of them, obviously, that come down the line, like getting your cycle, and then distribution of body fat starts to change. Mm-hmm. And then even like the physique in terms of the Q angle from hips to the knees and how that would put a female athlete a little bit more off balance. So where could creatine come into play and why should we be giving it to that population?
Yeah, so I think the big thing is that it improves a number of not only athletic performance or body composition variables. So it's well known that creatine, primarily in combination with weight training, let's be honest that the magic of creatine primarily gets unlocked with exercise, and the biggest stimulus is resistance training. So we've shown that it increases muscle and lean tissue mass. It can have some beneficial effects on decreasing fat mass. But the other area is if you increase bone density or bone strength, you're optimizing body composition. The other big thing is it serves as an anti-catabolic agent. So it preserves exactly what's in your body already. And if anything, it can cause some anabolic or growth potential. And where it decreases inflammation, you'll see some of those beneficial effects as well. Creatine from a hormonal regulation, it doesn't usually play a major role. It does increase some growth factors such as insulin-like growth factor 1 and some properties for bone health. It decreases myostatin, which is a regulator of muscle growth primarily in animals. Doesn't really have that much of a muscle myostatin effect. So it doesn't really regulate the menstrual cycle. For example, there's not a lot of research where creatine supplementation has influenced the luteal phase or the follicular phase. That's just something to keep in mind, that the heighten of estrogen or the cessation of estrogen during the different phases. But if anything, it can have some beneficial effects on creatine bioenergetics in the body, increasing energy status during certain types of the year, so to speak.
That's really cool. And what two thoughts I had come to mind is a lot of the female athletes that I work with, especially at that younger age, never hit protein targets, are not eating enough calories in general, are putting themselves at risk for relative energy deficiency in sport. So the anti-catabolic effects of creatine there, you sold me on that. Is that what you're seeing too? Like if we can mitigate some of the damage there?
Yeah, so we always try to measure dietary intake, and I'm a big proponent of the higher than the RDA for protein. So I think hopefully most exercising individuals are taking in additional dietary protein. And Stu Phillips from McMaster University, one of the world's leaders in protein research, is clearly shown, 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram or more is beneficial. And they gave a really nice range. You can even take up to a gram per pound. And that seems to be the maximal amount. I'm talking that if the individual is training almost every day a week, doing HIIT training or intense exercise, 1 gram per pound of protein per day seems to be the maximal limit, at least to turn it into a beneficial effects from protein or from a muscle perspective. But if you're increasing dietary protein, and you're actually emphasizing seafood or red meat, you're getting additional creatine there. But I think the big thing here is we don't know, can creatine rescue the effects of a low protein diet? I would hope that most individuals, primarily exercising individuals, are increasing dietary protein. I think it's a huge embarrassment that the RDA has not increased the 0.8 gram per kilogram. If you do the math, that means someone who's 70 kilograms only requires 56 grams of protein a day, which to me is almost criminal to tell someone that, because we now know as you get older, the minimal dose to offset sarcopenia is probably 1 to 1.2 grams. And if you're taking that low of protein, it's logical to think that, well, okay, you got to be taking in energy from carbohydrates and fat, and hopefully they're taking it in from complex carbohydrates and unsaturated fatty products. But my guess is you're probably inevitably taking refined carbohydrates, sugars, saturated trans fat. So I think the increase in protein is healthy from a longevity perspective and a recovery perspective. And who knows, if you're taking in an increase in dietary protein, the Mediterranean diet, whatever it is, from legumes and nuts and seeds and things like that, maybe some of your, protein-based foods could be red meat or lean meats and some seafood, and get the creatine that way if you're looking at it from a holistic perspective.
Definitely. And I think, like, speaking to longevity, is it's hard to come across for a young adult, let's say, but that's what I bring the conversation back to every single time. It's just like, sure, you might be able to get away with it for a few years, but this will catch up with you, and this will catch up with performance. The other question that kind of rang true was, you know, a lot of the pain that women experience period cramps with is that prostaglandin elevation. So would creatine have any impact there?
So unlike Advil, which it targets the prostaglandin and the COX inhibitor, so creatine is anti-inflammatory primarily from reducing proteins called cytokines. So for those who have gone and get their blood work, if they see these things called interleukin or tumor necrosis factor, these are cytokines that are elevated in response to exercise, and they're naturally elevated. If you do an intense workout and we were to measure these markers of inflammation in the blood, they're typically elevated. But there's really good evidence to suggest that creatine decreases the natural rise in these inflammatory markers. So it actually has some anti-inflammatory properties. And lo and behold, one of the biggest factors contributing to sarcopenia, or the age-related loss in strength, muscle mass, and performance, is something called inflam aging or heightened inflammation. I think the viewers, if you're over the age of 40, you're like, geez, I'm sore more often. I can't recover as much. I can't, train at the same intensity. We typically are popping Advil or Tylenol more often, but creatine actually has a lot of anti-inflammatory and anti-catabolic effects. So although you would typically consider creatine from a performance or health perspective, in general, it may help you recover from each exercise bout, allowing you to increase frequency of exercise over time. So, you know, if people don't want to take supplementation, that's totally fine. But if you're willing to have seafood or red meat for supper or lunch, maybe time that with your exercise bouts. That's an easy way to achieve it. So if you're at a restaurant and you want to choose pasta, or there's an option for salmon, choose the salmon. You're going to get protein, vitamin D, calcium, and creatine in that salmon. But again, if you're a vegan, you may need to look at other options.
Yeah, I love that. And pain, yeah, you're right. As we age, that's the main thing that I hear. Oh, I know I'm getting old because the pain is starting to creep up a little bit more. So that's a great suggestion.
And with that too, it's, you know, we've talked about dosage, and if you want to talk about the timing of creatine matter, or what you're allowed to take it with, those are important things we can talk about if you're interested in does the timing matter, or can you consume it with other products? Those are important variables for sure.
Yes, so. Fill me in. Can we consume it? Is there like optimization of dosing and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, so this is an area, it's a hot topic area, and my lab has actually probably performed the most on the creatine timing. And this got us pressed because people used to say, geez, get out of my way in the change room. I got to get my protein shake. If I don't consume it immediately after I work out, I'm going to deflate. And we now know that the timing of protein ingestion is irrelevant. It's the total daily amount. And just like that, the total daily amount of creatine is the most important. So for the viewers, you can consume creatine in the morning, before you work out. You can actually even consume it in water during your session. Take a small sip after every set, or you can consume it after your workout or before going to bed. They've all shown to be effective. So the timing of creatine does not necessarily matter per se. It definitely seems that the total daily amount, and it's not a lot, could be between 5 to 10 grams a day or even more. That's very easy to do. I personally mix mine in the morning with breakfast and Greek yogurt. And then I do take my creatine. I usually like to drink it during. Now, if I do a session on a Peloton, I just mix my creatine in my water when I'm drinking it, or I simply take it in my post-meal or post-exercise meal. So again, it doesn't really necessarily matter when you take it. And you can consume it with food, yogurt, juice, whichever it is. There was some evidence to suggest that if you mix creatine in coffee, over time, they negate each other. So I probably don't recommend mixing creatine in coffee or caffeinated beverages for the long term. So that's why if you're going to take a pre-workout that doesn't have creatine, you may just want to take your creatine after or split it up.
Okay, that's good to know. Did I read something as well with orange juice, creatine and orange juice? I think some of the guys came in and talked about that.
Yeah, so the cool thing with creatine is the more insulinogenic the food product is, it can stimulate getting into the muscle quicker. So that's why creatine in combination with carbohydrate is very effective. I will say creatine with protein is just as equally effective. A lot of people will want the refined sugars. However, if you want to mix it in grape juice or Gatorade or whichever and take it, that's totally fine as well, as long as the simple sugars are not an adverse effect. Obviously, for type 2 diabetes, that would be different. For athletes, it can get into your cells quicker. Yeah.
Okay. And then on a daily basis, would there be any like cognitive or focus or memory benefit to taking it first thing in the morning?
Yeah. So this is the big area. So I think taking it in multiple dosages, if you just want to take 5 grams a day and take it in one bolus dose, fine. If you want to split it up into two smaller dosages, that's fine as well. It takes a while to accumulate in the brain. So you got to be a little patient. But the interesting thing is the more stressed the brain is, the more supplementation has been shown to be effective. So in young, healthy individuals that don't have a lot of stressors, they're getting adequate sleep. Creatine may not cause you any noticeable effects. We start to see some major effects in sleep deprivation. So university students, people working graveyard shift, whichever it is. And I think everybody in today's society is sleep deprived, so to speak. It has been shown to have some beneficial effects. And then you look at some neurological conditions, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's. The more elevated the disease symptoms, that decreases brain creatine content, and that's where it can have some effects. And of course, the big area we're seeing a lot of promise is in concussions and depression. The two studies that have been done on concussion were in children, and when these children suffered head trauma, within 4 hours, they were actually administered either creatine or placebo for 6 months. And the children who had head trauma in consuming creatine actually got a huge increase in recovery, self-care, 6 months later, whereas the individuals on placebo didn't. So when the brain is stressed or traumatized, creatine supplementation may have some beneficial effects. Of course, we don't want anybody to have trauma or concussion, but of course, we see this in the National Football League and other athletes. And I think creatine could be a preventative strategy to take. God forbid, if you do get a concussion, it may speed up the recovery symptoms, which is good. And then, of course, in other areas of memory and cognition, we see older adults really respond well to memory and cognitive tasks in addition to creatine. So creatine seems to work really, really well from a muscle perspective and bone in combination with exercise. From the neck up, we're seeing benefits of creatine without exercise. So I think depending on why you want to take this, it could be something you take like a Flintstone vitamin when you were younger. You might just take this on a daily basis, go about your day, and you don't really need to know or have some effects. But if you know you got some major cognitive stressors coming up, or obviously we don't know the effects of COVID-19 on the mental capacity, and could creatine had an effect there? We just don't know. And we hope we never get a continuous epidemic anymore, but there's a lot of emphasis and we're writing a huge detailed review on just the cognitive effects potentially of creatine now. So we've evolved from just muscle, big biceps. I don't think anybody cares about your bicep anymore. More people say, I really want a brain health and potentially other beneficial effects. So it's evolved from just athletes to a something that could be considered for pretty much anybody on the planet. Even pregnant females actually get beneficial effects from energy status, and fetal development. So it's something to at least look into if you're considering it.
My brain is just going through all these brainstorms right now of all the applications of this. It's so cool. And it's something relatively so simple, right?
Yes.
You had mentioned pregnancy. So that's probably the next big female intervention. And so much is coming up now with like exercise and pregnancy and what those standards look like and what's safe and what's not safe. So I'm so excited to see that research starting to be done. And now this sounds like another great intervention that pregnant moms could take to help support whether it be their fitness journey or also the development of the child. Hey,
yeah, Stacey Ellery from Australia has put out the most papers and research articles there. And of course, you want to always check with your medical doctor to make sure supplementation of any form is safe. But those papers, and anybody can Google her name or creatine and pregnancy, and they'll come up, and they're open access, so you can get those. And they just go through the, again, this is evidence-based research suggesting some potential benefits. And a couple of my colleagues in the United States have looked at creatine in children. A lot of health benefits from not only overall health and performance, no negative effects there as well. And the argument is, if you take the recommended dosage, you know, in children, 3 to 5 grams a day, again, since we're naturally producing it, it just resembles what we naturally have. And that's probably why we don't see any adverse effects. But if you take in a high amount, for a continuous period of time, you're overloading the system, just like caffeine or even too much other ergogenic aids, beta-alanine and things like that. So I think a lot of education is needed. But again, it's just providing evidence from a scientific perspective about what it is. I'm always cautious, or tell my students, be cautious of what you take, because 99% of it is a placebo effect or can cause some adverse effects. There's only a handful of things out there that seem to be safe and effective, and creatine is definitely one of those.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. When we think about kids and dosing in children, like why would a parent consider creatine, or what would we be looking for potential benefits?
Yeah, I think the myth hopefully is gone that, you know, children can't lift weights or it stunts their growth. And of course, these are just things that are just mind-boggling in today's society. But any athlete that is exercising, or if they have some cognitive impairments, obviously you want to talk to your GP and neurologist. But creatine seems to have a huge beneficial effect on recovery and sports performance, and overall some beneficial effects from learning to memory. It's no different than an adult or an older adult. So again, if you're thinking of this for your children, you definitely want to look into the research. People can follow me on Instagram, and I can actually send them the articles with children and pregnancy. It's easy to do. I have access to a lot of articles, and they have a resource to even bring to their doctor. Unfortunately, most GPs know about creatine, but they're not going to about the supplementation, and they'll say, I don't want you to take it because your creatinine levels are high, and all you need to tell them is you're taking creatine supplementation. And hopefully they understand the mechanisms of why that is. But I probably get this asked every day. I went to my doctor and my creatinine levels were high, and I say, are you on supplementation? They're saying yes. And I was like, that totally makes sense, because if you take a supplement, the byproduct of creatine supplementation is something called creatinine, which is on any blood requisition form. You just need to be honest with your doctor and let them know why that is.
Definitely. And then I like this sleep part of things. So I have a 1-year-old who does not sleep very well. And I read in that same book, The Double X Brain, that, you know, we're looking at deficits of 700 plus hours for that, for a mom in the first year of motherhood.
Oh, wow. My God.
So crazy. Hey.
And
that's for probably like a relatively good sleeping baby. So what would we be hopeful if we did supplement creatine in that first year? Like, what could we potentially be looking at? Like, is it entering deeper stages of sleep? Is it just feeling more like, what's the mechanism that we're looking at?
It seems to have almost a recovery or a therapeutic effect, from the anti-fogness to more energy to more focus and clarity. Those seem to be the biggest things when the brain is sleep deprived or under times of metabolic stress. This creatine supplementation will overcome the decrease in brain creatine stores and overcome some of those. So you may have more energy, but the anti-fogness and memory and cognition seems to be elevated. Again, there's only a handful of studies on that, and more research needs to be there. It's very similar to people who experience depression and anxiety. When we look at their brain creatine stores, they're really reduced, primarily with depression. So if you elevate your brain creatine stores with supplementation, there is some good evidence to suggest that creatine can decrease symptoms of depression. Primarily, it's been shown in animals, and there is some studies in females and males on a pharmaceutical intervention, but creatine by itself hasn't been shown to have huge implications on depression, but that is coming. So again, it's been shown to decrease some of the symptoms of depression and anxiety and PTSD in a couple cases. So it seems to have some beneficial or therapeutic effects. So if you know you have a huge cognitive stressor coming up, or as you said, you're sleep deprived, this could be something to take, not so much from a muscle perspective, but you may want to increase the dosage, especially for you, to get those cognitive and bone beneficial effects.
Interesting. The last kind of, well, I shouldn't say that. Menopause always gets said as the last phase of a woman's life, and that's not true at all. It's just like another hurdle that we go through, right? So I don't want to phrase it that way, but for perimenopause, menopausal changes, like what could, on a layman's terms, why would we consider it, and what potentially could it do for a woman going through that transition?
Yeah, the biggest thing is offsetting the rate of bone mineral density loss and increasing bone strength. So for example, we spend in Canada $700 million on hip replacement surgeries every year. So a young individual in Canadian winters can fall, and you know, it's embarrassing, but you can just bounce back up. An older individual, when they fall, they may break an ankle or, God forbid, a hip. Hip replacement surgery means that you're inactive, and that can lead to obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease. So during the menopausal transition, and primarily into the postmenopausal years, we definitely see an improvement in bone mineral density, strength, and bone health. So that could have huge implications for decreasing the risks of fracture and inevitably increasing the risk of falls prevention. We definitely see an increase in lean tissue mass, but also we get an increase in strength. So if you translate that into activities of daily living, hopefully as we get older, we can improve our functionality and live longer free of dependence.
I love this. And when I think about this athletic crowd and the perimenopausal, menopausal athletes, I again see often that they're not consuming enough protein, they're not eating enough in general. And then with the changes the hormones play in menopause, you know, weight tends to sit around the midsection a little bit more. So our age-old go-to is restrict calories and train harder. So I'm glad that there's, you know, something that we have as an intervention-wise that's going to help with bone mineral density, because all of those would lead to more, you know, bone catabolism or breakdown, right?
And during that transition, there's two things you brought up that are interesting. You need to increase your dietary protein as you get older. We used to tell people decrease it. Now we've completely failed in that area. You need to be increasing it. So anybody over the age of 40 listening, you need at least 1.2 grams per kilogram a day if you're an exercising individual. And even sedentary, you could argue that's the minimal amount to offset the age-related loss of muscle and strength. But for those on a lower calorie diet, you need to increase your protein even more. So if you reduce your energy, please don't reduce your protein. If anything, increase it. You're going to feel fuller throughout the day. You're going to have more clarity. That's going to be beneficial from an exercise performance. And that way you decrease the chance of trans fat and refined sugar. So if you're going on a hypocaloric diet, and most people with the holidays coming up say, hey, I'm going to eat whatever I want and then go on a New Year's resolution, make sure you really increase your protein when you're reducing the simple refined sugars and trans fat, which we typically do during the New Year's resolution. You're going to get a greater rate of recovery, and those are beneficial effects.
Cool. No, that's great timing for that. tip as well. I could ask you 8 billion questions. I find this absolutely fascinating. One of the ones that was still sticking in my mind is this concussion aspect of things. Yes. So I read a study years ago now, a few years back, that it was saying, like, if you are deficient in creatine, then supplementation with creatine. But it sounds like we're practically all deficient, especially on a brain marker sense, right? So is some of your standards, or some of what you're suggesting now, is like that continual supplementation to prevent and then maybe help recovery from concussion?
Yeah. So a bit of clarity, we wouldn't all be deficient in brain creatine levels, but the evidence is suggesting that additional brain creatine levels has some beneficial effects. So most individuals, you know, they live long, healthy lives. But we started to see the evidence for this, to your point, when individuals are born with creatine deficiency syndrome. That means they can't create their brain creatine levels to the amount that's needed, and it's led to a lot of medical complications. To overcome that, when they gave creatine supplementation primarily to these young individuals, they seemed to live long, healthy lives. Cognitive ability was there. So that led the way, well, what about technically healthy individuals increasing creatine in the brain, could that lead to greater beneficial effects? And the mounting evidence and accumulating evidence is suggesting that is. So that's why I say the 5 gram a day is great. It'll accumulate in the brain, but that's probably going to take multiple weeks, if not months, to notice any effect. If you slightly increase the amount in addition to the general recommended amount, especially if you're an exercising individual, you have an occupation that's really mentally taxing, there's a lot of stressors. Yeah, you want to increase that to overcome the natural rate of turnover that's happening in the body. So again, my big thing in clinical research, don't just think about the size of your bicep. Think about the size of your brain and bone as well. It's probably more important. Yeah,
there's a lot that goes into it. Hey, and so many pieces of information because we just put creatine on a shelf and said, you'll grow bigger muscles. So that's so cool. So where are you taking all of this next? Where are you taking all of this research?
Yeah, we have a lot of big things. We're right now proposing creatine for older adults that are diagnosed with sarcopenia. So they have a certain condition. That'll be a long-term study. And of course, we're always looking at the effects on cognition. Female health is a big one as well, postmenopausal females. And I can't elaborate too much, but hopefully we have a study being published here soon where we looked at postmenopausal females who took a higher dose creatine, about 9 to 10 grams a day for 2 straight years. And we looked at bone density, muscle, and it seemed to have some very beneficial effects on bone, no adverse effects. And hopefully that'll be published in a medical journal in January. And so we're really focusing on the medical and health aspects of that. The next population is individuals with frailty and cachexia from cancer. We think the catastrophic effects of cancer on muscle and bone might be hopefully being overcome or rescued with some creatine and exercise. So those are the big areas that we're looking at. But again, we're still looking at the younger population, primarily looking at young, healthy females. Again, not a lot of studies there. And actually looking at the cognitive effects, not only from a self-esteem, but improving body composition, but maybe having some mental health capacity there. And that's some studies we'll hopefully have planned here in 2023, looking at young females as well.
I love the sounds of that. And especially when we look at those statistics in puberty, how, you know, anxiety and depression skyrocket.
Yes.
And we are seeing numbers obviously elevated in the male population too, but it seems to be, you know, aggressively more in females and with that, you know, postmenopausal timeframe as well.
That's correct. Yeah.
One last thing that I have to mention or have to ask you about is, endurance athletes and runners and stuff like that. So we always, again, put creatine in this muscle growth format. But you showed me a pretty cool paper that was talking about, you know, the benefits for runners.
Yes. Yeah, it's we're literally just writing a review as well on all endurance sports. And before, we never used to think creatine was beneficial for endurance or aerobic sports, because if you increase body size, that may decrease performance and speed and agility. But it's seeming to have a beneficial effect on some components of aerobic or endurance capacity. It's improving soccer and sports related performance from an agility perspective to an endurance perspective. And the big thing is it seems to speed up recovery. So in those papers I showed you in marathon and triathlon, if you take creatine before the big race, if you have a 40K marathon coming up or you're a triathlon or athlete, it seems to decrease the amount of inflammation post-exercise. So what they started to see is if you take creatine for about 5 days before the big race, and you do it in a safe and effective way where it doesn't increase body mass heightenly, you can actually have a decrease in inflammation after the race. That may allow you to recover and get back to training more frequently. So it's starting to have some really beneficial effects from an aerobic or endurance perspective. Now, when it comes to a body weight type of sport, where if you increase mass, muscle or body weight, that could hinder your performance, maybe something like swimming or rhythmic gymnastics or, obviously UFC or something where you need to cut a lot of weight for the weigh-in, creatine may not be something to be considered all the time. But obviously from a training and recovery perspective, it's something to consider.
Maybe in that off season timeframe, hey?
That's correct. That's perfect timing. Yeah. Yeah,
definitely.
For sure.
No, thank you so much. This information is so influential and something so safe and straightforward. I get asked all the time, like, what is the new ergogenics? Like, what are we going to do for brain capacity? And I'm just like, maybe we could stick to the basics for a lot of stuff. Yeah. And with all of the research coming out, I think this is a really great intervention, hey?
That's right. Yeah. The key is you got to exercise. Mm-hmm. That's the foundation. And all these little supplements are kind of like icing on the cake. They might just make little things taste better. But at the end of the day, if you don't exercise, these are not magic pills and powders. They're probably going to have a minimal to moderate effect. But when you add it with exercise, you may get a greater effect.
Have you noticed anything like personally with the supplementation regime that you've been doing? What have you noticed?
Yeah. So as I got older, and unfortunately, I have some partial tears in my inferens supraspinatus. So the pressing motions have gone down probably from wear and tear, but the cognitive effects for sure. I notice I have a really stressful, from a brain perspective, job. Academics is very stressful, and I have a lot of other interests. So I noticed from recovery, I've had to increase almost double my daily dose to get the same effects. So I take again 10 grams a day. And from a brain perspective, it's really helped. When I take time off, which, geez, I can't remember the last time I did, I did notice an effect. And that's another thing. If you need to take time off from supplementation, don't freak out and worry. The benefits stay in your muscles for at least 30 days. So if someone says, I ran out of creatine, I ordered it from Amazon or wherever and it's delayed, don't worry. The benefits stay in your muscles once they're saturated for 30 days. So some people say, should I cycle it or continuous? I say, you can do both. It's up to you if you want to take it on a daily basis. But if you want to cycle it, that's fine. Just know that the benefits stay elevated for 30 days after you stop taking it.
That's good to know. Some of us become so ritualistic. If it's not there, it just gets deleted from your brain, right?
Yeah. If you go to Mexico and all-inclusive, you're probably not taking a white powder across the border. And I said, that's totally fine. It stays in your muscles for a while. We don't know how long it stays in the bone or brain. But my guess is it would probably stay there as well. It might not have as much turnover as muscle. And that's a question that needs to be addressed.
Cool. Well, all the more research you get to do, hey?
That's right, exactly.
Definitely. So yeah, when I reached out to you, you were so informative, just throwing papers at me, and that's something that I dream about. So that was so awesome, and I'm so appreciative of that. Where could people like reach out to you, or where can they find you? I know you're a busy guy, but...
Yeah, I think the biggest area is Instagram, which is ironic. I don't think anybody reads our Born articles on some of the databases, but Instagram seems to be the most prevalent. So you can just reach me at Dr. Darren Kando. If you have any questions, just direct message me. I can send you articles with that. And I typically post a lot of research, not just on creatine, but other health aspects on my page. So please feel free to follow me, and that'd be great.
Yeah, such great info. Is there any ask that you have? Like, are you looking for people to participate? Is the research always kind of seeking people out?
Yeah, I have 7 graduate students at this time. And the big push now is in 2023, now that COVID is sort of dwindling down in a sense, if we can be smart and research gets back up and going. But we always put out calls for research participants, and I'll be doing that on Instagram and things like that as well. So stay tuned. There's lots of opportunities coming up.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it so much. And this is just a wealth of information for anyone listening.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. We'll chat again soon.
Okay. Thanks.
So that wraps another episode of The Off Season. Thank you guys so much for listening. We always appreciate that. If you'd like to follow along with us, it's at theoffseason.podcast. We always appreciate a rate and good review and share. The whole point of sharing this information and doing these episodes is to educate as much as possible. So if you think somebody else would really learn something here, we would really appreciate that share.